don't have to use these types of devices, it's better off just not using them at all, I think. Especially if you're going to use communications gear, and especially if you're trying to listen to very, very weak signals in DX, it can be harmful. I don't know if it gets mixed. KC2QIQ, back over to you, Dick.
That rig you're using now, Glenn, nice strong carrier, dead full quieting. But your audio is only 20% as loud as it should be. That particular rig has got very low audio. You're either going to have to turn it up or shout into it a little bit. Now, I'd like to go to the Grumman site and read some of your editorial pages for the Grumman newspaper. Bob, sounds fascinating. However, you said one very pregnant clause to me, that you wrote an article that debunked SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Yes, it's a controversial subject, but without getting too deep into it right now, what made you write an article about SETI? W2ILP, K2RIW.
K2RIW, W2ILP. There's a long history to this. I've debunked SETI almost since the start of the program. And one way is recognizing the one-way radar range equation and realizing how close the nearest planets in the universe could be to the Earth, where there could be intelligent life. We're talking about tens of, well, even hundreds of light years away. And if you put that into the radar range equation, where they were looking at microwave frequencies for receiving the signal, even with a large aperture antenna and a lot of other things plugged into that, the highest gain cryogenic receiver and whatnot, you couldn't pick up these planets. The nearest stars to us are not likely to have planets around them. They're either much hotter than our star, our sun, or much weaker than our sun. The planets that are really out there, that they're now discovering planets around the suns out there, the stars out there, are way too far to get a signal that's not vastly attenuated and couldn't be received. And even the people who took over from Sagan realized that it's no longer practical. And you yourself as an antenna man know that to get a high gain antenna, it would have to be pointed accurately at the planet. And this in itself is a problem, because you can't correct it along the way. You have to correct it only once. Unless you use repeaters going out into space, and that's another problem because of the time to get them out on position. When we're talking about things that are 100 light years away, they get off SETI. I've got this blog on IEEE Spectrum where it was an editorial of the three cultures of climate science. And I don't believe that man-made greenhouse effect is as effective as the variation in solar radiation that we're going to measure cyclically, which we know affects the ionosphere for ham radio HF propagation. And the Russian observatory, astronomical observatory...
Repeater, time out.
You created a double error on that transmission, Bob. You talk for a length of time that's capable of timing out the machine, and I can tell you're emotionally involved in that subject. You picked up before the machine gave you a beep. You were doubly timed out, so to speak. But I know where you're standing, and I'm hearing you on the input, so don't worry. I got all the words. There's a degree of accuracy in everything you've said. Yes, the one-way radar range equation, inverse square law, and you're talking about tens of light years of distance between the nearest stars capable of having Earth-like planets with liquid water on them makes the search for extraterrestrial intelligence very, very difficult. However, I wonder how familiar you are with a multi-channel spectrum analyzer. Assuming that the signal of interest was not necessarily aimed at us, just an unintentional radiation, like our broadcast transmitters, if you have a narrow enough bandwidth on your post-detection integration, post-detection processing of your receiver, assuming the signal being transmitted is sufficiently coherent, or if it has a degree of spread spectrum characteristic which is predictable, under those conditions, give me a guess, Bernie, as to how weak, in dB with reference to a microvolt, do you think the weakest signal detector could be? If you and I were building a state-of-the-art signal detector, how weak a signal do you and I think, do you think you and I could build that would make a go, no-go decision that yes, a signal is there? Wait for the beep this time, and relax once every 60 seconds. W2ILP, K2RIW.
K2RIW, W2ILP, yeah, I mean, if you look at Shannon's probability, but a lot of these things are not that clear because we don't know what frequency or how spread, or the more complex the wave and the more spread out, according to Dixon, you have a better probability. However, what happens is, if you don't know what you're looking for, you have a less of a probability. You have to know how it differs from atmospheric noise before you can take it out of the noise. And that's what the problem is. And when we start talking about, this guy Drake wrote an equation about the probability of there being intelligent life out there just based on the number of planets that probably are out there, which if the universe is infinite, it could be infinite, but most of them are going to be far out of our range. It doesn't matter how they transmit the energy, and if they spread it out and broadcast it, it's not going to be that concentrated, because whatever antenna they're sending it from is not directional, doesn't have any directional gain as far as we're concerned. Is it just the music of the spheres out there? I mean, we're kidding ourselves. We're not going to pick up anything that doesn't have some coherence to it, or at least its own spectrum that differs something from the Gaussian white noise of the universe. So I just don't believe it. I don't believe that the Drake equation applies to us, because just because there's a lot of dandelions that come up every May, it doesn't mean that some of them have intelligent ants on them. Just because there's a lot of them out there doesn't prove anything, because both of these probabilities are incoherent to each other. So I just don't believe in it. And if you read some of these things like the Black Swan Principle and quite a few others, you can't disprove that it's possible, but it's not probable in my mind because of the one-way radar range equation. And I'm probably dropping out, so let me pass it back.
Yeah, you did it again, Wesley. You talked for 2.5 minutes, and you picked up without waiting for the beep. I can tell you're emotionally involved in the subject. The Drake equation, a very respected equation, done by Frank Drake roughly 1966, I think it was, during the time that the National Radio Astronomy Observatory first set up their first 85-foot diameter dish as a very serious microwave radio telescope, he talked the vendor into supplying that dish 1 month ahead of time. And he conducted Project Ozma, which was a one-month search of the nearest candidate stars that he thought likely would contain life, and he listened in those directions and didn't hear anything. But and then the Drake equation tries to pin down all of the variables involved. Are you familiar with the fact that the Drake equation is now known to be 100,000 to 1 too pessimistic, that the number of life entities that you can detect according to the Drake equation is 100,000 times greater than his original prediction? Are you familiar with that, Bernie? Please wait for the beep this time and interrupt once every 60 seconds. Over to you, Bernie.
You're talking to me. The name is Bob Baker, Obo Baker, not Bernie. And I've known you for many years. Sat with you at tables at IEEE functions, and probably you don't picture me. My voice is very bad now because I'm suffering from the flu, and I have a very raspy voice, so it's not my new usual. Anyway, you have to read my article to see all my objections to SETI. And I see that even the SETI advocates are now going to what they call optical SETI. They're trying to say perhaps they're sending us a light signal. So, I don't know too much about that, but what's more relevant now, and I don't want to hold up this this discussion because it gets too long. That time. I waited for the beep that time because the big subject today that affects all of us is climate change theories. And I feel that a lot of radio amateurs are aware of the sunspot cycles and so forth that affect HF propagation. And I started as a shortwave listener when I was 8 years old, and I'm now 76 years old, and I've seen us go through a few 11-year cycles, so I believe it exists. And I do believe that the radiation from the sun's variation may be enough to cause the global warming that we're seeing now, more than anything that's man-made. So, back to you, Dick, from W2ILP. Comment.
Wesley recognized. I'm terrible on names, Bob. I get lots of names mixed up, and people get a little unhappy with me over that, and I deserve it. Your voice right now sounds like a man I know with whatever name I used before. I'm terrible at names, as you can tell. I gave you the wrong name. I think I called you Bernie. Yeah. There's a man I know named Bernie who has a voice that sounds just like your current voice. That's creating some of the confusion. I'm looking at your picture right now on QIZ.com, and it's too bad that I keep mixing you up. Sorry about that. We'll have a further discussion on SETI, but the main point I was going to make is that Drake used to believe that to have planets going around a star is a rather rare event. He estimated in the beginning it was roughly 1 per million. Each million stars would have a good set of planets. The current research is leading us to believe that 10% or more of all the stars have planets. And because the majority of the planets we've discovered so far, let me drop, happen to be Jupiter-sized planets in close, doesn't mean that that's where the majority of the planets are. The methods of detection used up till now can find heavy planets in close a lot more easily. And by way of the Kepler telescope, we're going to find out what the real ratio is. How many Earth-like planets in the Goldilocks zone really are there? And Kepler in the next couple of years is going to give us that answer. Or at least with that particular chunk of sky that it's looking at in the Cygnus galaxy. in the Cygnus constellation direction, assuming that that's typical, and it's looking at 100,000 stars all at once. So we're going to be getting some answers. If you don't make a leap of faith and start looking for a pink elephant, you can never prove that there never was a pink elephant. And so I'm with you that we shouldn't put a tremendous amount of our resources into SETI, but not to do any of it. There's some strong disadvantages of that. There's a certain kind of philosophy that develops in the mind of a scientist when he admits the possibility that he's not the only thing. That when he comes down a little bit from his level of arrogance to realize that he may not be the only thing in this universe and starts looking for other living organisms, there's some very good things that come out of that. So there's some beneficial outcome from doing a SETI search, even if you don't hit success. By the same token, let me drop. NASA developed some really beautiful hardware in the process of doing the Apollo program and getting a man on the moon. If I wanted to be severe, I could say we spent $30 billion and all we got is a couple of hundred pounds of lunar soil as a result. If I want to be severe. In reality, the process of getting that lunar soil and bringing it back and putting man on the moon allowed us to develop some beautiful navigating computer programs and space hardware and boosters and space shields and high temperature materials and so on, and biomedical monitoring instrumentation. A lot of good, and put a lot of people to work. A lot of very good science took place as a side effect. The majority of the benefit we got out of the space program, by probably 50 to 1, was not getting the soil. It's the process of getting there that gave us the benefit, not the fact that we got there and brought the stuff back and brought the men back. Bunch of opinions on that one. So I'm looking forward to reading it. If I Google the word Grumman and newsletter, hopefully I'll find it. Wesley wanted to make some comments. Go ahead, Wesley. And after that, we gotta go to the mailbag. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Okay. Right after Tunguska meteor, this is N2XJN, crash, because there was a lot of notion about it, Russians came to the conclusion that they have to go with a certain experiment, and then finally they went to the philosophical discussion with the scientists. And some of the smart people came with the number of 22,000. They actually claim that the probability of somebody finding us instead of us finding somebody at year of 1959 was 22,000 versus 1. So 22,000 times, which means 22,000%. There is a bigger probability of us being found than people finding life in space. Now, in 1961, Russian provided very interesting experiment. It was a military covert experiment. They built something that looks like a alien spaceship. Everybody knows their shape. And there was a rotary device inside on the surface of that shape, and then they moved it with the great speed. And they were using the different sound frequencies. Sound, I'm talking about sound frequencies. And the results were very much covered, but it looks like that device was able to move from point A to point B with very, very short periods of time, 8 seconds. And actually the people they were inside didn't even notice that they actually went somewhere. Similar incident is being recorded in the United States of America in 1966, which actually this incident is kind of myth. So people say about it, it's just fabricated. Let me drop for a moment. When similar kind of device was built by Department of Defense, and the witnesses actually said, one of them is former NASA employee, that they were volunteering inside that vehicle. And again, there were other witnesses, they saw several kilometers or several miles away the same spaceship or whatever device being over there, but they didn't even notice that this happened. So coming from this very comic subject to something that is more scientific. I went across the experiment. If it's important, I can give you all of the information. I wasn't prepared to have it right now with me. There was a cage made from the glass. Inside the cage, there were speakers. And there were very high power amplifiers. And there was inside there was a device that actually, when they moved the generators, they were able to levitate that object. It's a video on it, it's the information on it, so you can read about it. So that object was able not only to be levitating, but more or less precisely, they were able to change the position of that flying object, and also they were able to flip it up and down. Back to you, Dick.
Fascinating that a prediction was made that there's many times more probability they are seeing us than we seeing them. And if you think about it, it has to be that way. As you do more and more study of where we stand in the universe, we're right in the middle. Of all the technological progress that has taken place in the universe, of all of the conditions, lives of stars and whatever, we're right in the middle. That tells me of all the extraterrestrial intelligence that's out there, half of it is ahead of us, technologically speaking, and half of it is behind us. We're right in the middle. If you'd like to think that we're the head of the pack, that we're the smartest thing around, it takes a lot of arrogance to come up to that conclusion. We're not the beginning of the race, we're not the end of the race. We're somewhere in the middle. And there's zillions of possibilities. And quite a few of those societies, in the process of developing their ethics and developing their progress, you could speculate that they came up with something equivalent to the Prime Directive. Don't interfere. Because if you do interfere, there's a high probability you're going to destabilize the society you interfere with. Leave them alone. And if we've been observed, they wouldn't bother telling us for a whole bunch of reasons. You could speculate that, and you can make a very good case. Okay, let's go over to the mailbag. I know we were supposed to start at 11 o'clock. We promised. We're not good at keeping our promises. I'm not good at keeping our promises, Mel. K2KEY, choose one or two of them at least, and even if you don't have them in front of you, what you remember, what would they who write to you like to discuss? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Says K2KEY, well, haven't been one privy to, when I went to the University of Ohio. I won't get into that now about the WOW signal, but that's a whole other portion of the SETI project, and I agree with you 100%, Dick. If I was out there somewhere traveling and I take a look at this world, I have that capability to transverse across this universe, and maybe I'm aboard the Starship Enterprise, and Captain Kirk there is in all the same warp speed, and coming by and take a look at this Earth, I would say, these crazy here, let them do what they want to do, let's just take a look and keep going. So I believe, as I can say, that we are most likely somewhere in the middle. They've observed and they've moved on. Anyhow, I'm just looking for something. Here's one that comes up very often. Problem with, well, I think we can jam it in. You would want to discuss at least the beginning of this one. Tuners, over.
By tuners, I presume you mean antenna tuners. And yes, they can do magic. It's kind of sad that the rigs that used to exist in your and my time, like a Heathkit DX100, a Collins 75A4, or maybe that's a receiver, but the Collins equipment, many of these pieces of equipment had a real high output tuning network, resonating network on the final stage, the final tube, and many of those PI output networks would cover a substantial portion of the Smith chart as to what impedance of an antenna they would tolerate and properly handle. Many of those transmitters in our day could easily handle, in my opinion, a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio at most of the possible phase angles. We've all said to the manufacturers, we want the transmitter to be more and more compact. And one very big voluminous circuit that used to be in there is that PI tuning network. So they got rid of the PI tuning network, and we so-called have fixed-tuned transmitters. That's the good news. But those fixed-tuned transmitters cannot tolerate more than maybe a 1.5, a 1.7, a 1.8 standing wave ratio. You go beyond that, and the rig goes into a self-protect mode. Either stops transmitting entirely or goes to a lower power output. So we got the compact rig, we got rid of the voluminous PI tuning network, but now we're very sensitive to standing wave ratio. And you add a tuner, and you're back to where you used to be. There's no magic there. And the tuner, a properly built tuner, does have very close to 100% efficiency. You apply 100 watts to it, and 99 watts is going to go to the antenna. And a well-made tuner will probably tolerate a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio at many of the possible phase angles you give it. And of all the power being reflected by your antenna, there's a ridiculous number of people out there who think the antenna tuner simply absorbs that reflected power. Absolutely not. When you properly adjust that antenna tuner, it takes every bit of that power being reflected by your antenna, because it has a less than ideal load resistance for your transmission line. If you're using 50 ohm transmission line, the antenna better be a 50 ohm resistor, nothing else. Otherwise, you're going to get some amount of reflected power. And it's a relatively easy thing to calculate once you know the impedance of the antenna. Or you can measure it with a good standing wave ratio bridge, Berg watt meter, whatever. But your antenna tuner, when you properly adjust its controls, it takes every bit of that reflected power from the antenna, re-reflects it forward. Not only re-reflects it forward, re-reflects it forward in phase with the power being generated by your transmitter right now, and adds those two signals together in a voltage manner. That's the magic. The bottom line is, if your transmission line is low enough in insertion loss, no matter how bad your antenna is, within reason, your whole system becomes 1-to-1 standing wave ratio as far as the transmitter is concerned, and 99% potential transmitting efficiency. What more do you want? Ain't that beautiful? Now, maybe you want to get into the details of how it does that, but it really is, in most cases, the PI tuning network we used to have. Now we pay extra for it, put it external, and we put it back into the system. That's a whole set of strong opinions. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, the question has come up, and right off the top of my head, at least a few times, is that when they adjust the tuner, put the tuner in the line and adjust it for a nice match, so the transmitter is happy to see the nice one-to-one. But how come in a couple of conditions, they said, a couple people have mentioned, that the people on the other end have reported their signal is not as strong? And even though the meters seem to agree with what your statement was, that now they've got the transmitter looking in a very nice load, but when they take the tuner out, even though the SWR may rise somewhat up, that the signal is better. So what is happening? This is what the question is. Other than maybe possibly is it a cheap tuner or something missing, or exactly why is it that here the standing wave now is higher without the tuner, but they are being received much better, and in most cases they even said hearing better, Dick, over.
Question.
WQIRP.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Wesley, Bob, and Glenn, in that order. I can think of at least three things that can happen here. Number one, if you're using a brand X antenna tuner, it could have a substantial amount of insertion loss. That's a little bit rare, but possible. Number two, many of the antenna tuners are automatic antenna tuners, and some of them have a less than ideal design or a possible hang-up impedance. Many an automatic antenna tuner, when you give it a particular load impedance, the motors will grind and grind and it never comes to a solution, or the solution it comes to is a poor solution. In some cases, the antenna tuner can be tuned two different ways in order to present a 50 ohm load to the transmitter. And one of those is a very undesirable tuning, where the antenna tuner becomes very lossy because you're using one of the controls at maximum, and you've chosen the undesirable solution. A third possibility is that some transmitters, when fed, when they're feeding a particular, let me drop, when they're feeding a particular impedance, will develop more power output. I could have a transmitter which produces 100 watts when looking into 50 ohms. It might produce 120 watts output when it loses, when it looks into 25 ohms without tripping out. There are some transmitters that will do that. So in order to really cure, to figure out what's going on, the guy should be looking at his instrumentation, telling him what is the standing wave ratio the transmitter is seeing. That's good. But if he had a bird watt meter on the output of the antenna tuner, on the feed line going to the antenna, under almost all normal conditions, the total amount of forward power should be maximum when the antenna tuner finishes its alignment, and that amount of forward power in most cases should be greater than it would be without the antenna tuner. So in order to really resolve what's going on, there should be a bird watt meter looking at forward and reverse power, particularly forward power, after the antenna tuner. Many antenna tuners have instrumentation built in that'll tell you what VISWR the transmitter is seeing. I'm not sure that all of them have a VISWR meter that can be adjusted for the output of the antenna tuner, and not VISWR meter, but a forward and reverse power indicating circuit for the output of the antenna tuner. You may have to do that with your own bird watt meter on the outside. That's part of what I think is going on. I believe it's Bob, Wesley, and Glenn in that order. Bob first, W2ILP, K2RIW.
There is a lot of misinformation going on at all times, and I've yelled my brains off trying to explain the misinformation. What you call an antenna tuner or an antenna coupler serves two different functions. One function is to match the output impedance of the transmitter to the impedance of the antenna. And this can be done automatically very well with very little insertion loss. However, if the antenna is far from resonance, the tuner is looking at a complex load that's either reactive or inductive, and the tuner has to make up for that reactance or inductance by canceling it out. In order to do that, it's actually placing part of the antenna in the tuner. So the part of the antenna that's in the tuner does not radiate. And when I worked for Collins Rockwell, I worked on automatic antenna tuners that are used on 707 aircraft. They work on HF from 2 to 30 megahertz, and they feed probe antennas. And we had a way of measuring the output with electrostatic voltmeters, because the output can be at a very high voltage. And we also have a thermocouple type current meter. And we know what the losses are in the antenna tuner when it's tuned up to a non-resonant antenna, because there's a lot of loss in there, believe me, depending on the frequency that you're using. And it's not due to the type of problem that you're talking about, because if it was just a matter of matching the impedance to a resonant antenna, the insertion loss would be exactly as you described, Dick. Back to you.
Okay, I've got a direct question for you, Bob. And it's going to be based on your Collins experience and your other RF experience. I'll warn you, this is a fairly tough question. Let's assume now that I've got an antenna that is off resonance, as you described. And by the way, off resonance is just a fancy way of saying the antenna presents an inductive load or a capacitive load. If the antenna is not a pure resistor, even if it's 25 ohms or 100 ohms when I want 50, if it's not a pure resistor, by definition by me, it is reactive. If it's reactive, it is off resonance. It's either high or low in frequency. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a reactance. So, whether or not I'm getting reflected power because the antenna is reactive, or whether I'm getting reflected power because the antenna is the wrong resistance, or whether I'm getting reflected power because of some combination, in all three of those cases, there's a certain amount of power flowing backwards down that line. But now let's take the worst case condition that you just described. The antenna is off resonance, and the resonance is being reestablished by way of the antenna tuner. Let me drop. So starting off from that worst case condition, the antenna is off resonance, resonance is being reestablished inside of the antenna tuner, and I've got a properly calibrated bird wattmeter looking at forward transmitted power on the transmission line going to the antenna. Even when the antenna tuner is reestablishing resonance, assuming my antenna tuner is well designed and essentially lossless, it's running ice cold, it's not getting hot, and it's well shielded. When I'm using that antenna tuner, when it's reestablishing resonance, I am saying the forward power on that transmission line most of the time will be maximum, will be the greatest. And if I eliminate the antenna tuner, the amount of forward power will be less. Now, there's a slight exception to that. Certain transmitters, when looking at 25 ohms, will put out more power. That's a little bit unfair. If my transmitter is trying to put out the same amount of power, I am saying that with the antenna tuner, the power that I sense going forward with that wattmeter after the antenna tuner will always be greater and be maximum. That's what I'm saying. I think you said something different, and if so, you and I should discuss it. W2ILP, K2RIW, you got it, Bob. Wait for the beep.
K2RIW from W2ILP. You got your bird wattmeter in the wrong place. The only way you can put a bird wattmeter in there is between the transmitter and the tuner. Once you're feeding a non-resonant antenna, you have a complex load at the output of the tuner, And a bird watt meter is a through line for 50 ohms. It's not designed to work at the potentials that you're going to find at the output of the tuner that's feeding a complex load. So anything you do there can't be done with a bird watt meter. It has to be done with an electrostatic voltmeter and a thermocouple current meter. And there is where you can see your RF power coming out of the tuner to the antenna. And you will find that the further away from resonance you are, your automatic tuner will put more inductance in if it has to match a capacitive load, and put more capacity in if it has to match an inductive load. But the automatic antenna tuner, the 180R17, is quite complex. It not only has a rotating coil, it has a rotating cap on it, and it has capacitors that get cut in, vacuum capacitors that get switched in at various times when the thing is really far off resonance. So it's really quite a thing. The output insulation has to be capable of taking at least 3,000 volts, which exists at the output during the course of tuning up. And the voltage there is much higher than you would get across a normal 50-ohm connector and coax. So once we talk about the output of an antenna tuner that's working with a transmitter that's capable of 600 watts PEP, we're not talking about something you could use a bird watt meter at the output of the antenna coupler. Back to you, Dick, from W2ILP.
Comment.
Wesley recognized. Don't agree. And you and I are going to part the ways here a little bit, Bob. First of all, I've got the resources, you got the resources, to put two bird watt meters in the system. One between the transmitter and the antenna tuner. That's the one you want to favor, and I understand that. And I'm also going to want to put one after the antenna tuner on the transmission line going to the antenna. And yes, I'm going to agree with you that when I properly adjust the antenna tuner, the first watt meter will see on an ordinary transmitter 100 watts going forward and essentially 0 watts going back. A 1-to-1 standing wave ratio, the first bird watt meter will see. I think you and I are in agreement on that one. However, what I am saying is that the bird watt meter on the output for a transmitter that's always trying to put out 100 watts, that bird watt meter on the output will hit maximum apparent forward power when I properly adjust that antenna tuner. What I am saying is that if I twiddle the knobs on the antenna tuner, the antenna matching device, whatever you want to call it, and I maximize the apparent forward power on the output bird watt meter, I don't even have to look at the input bird watt meter. If I had a pure 50-ohm transmitter, there's a big catch. No transmitter we own with a constant current tetro tube is really a 50-ohm source. But if I had a pure 50-ohm source transmitter, and I can do that by taking an ordinary transmitter and put it through a great big 10 dB attenuator, 50-ohm, high-power 10 dB attenuator. Start off with a kilowatt transmitter, put it through a 10 dB attenuator that's rated for a kilowatt. And I've got 100 watts coming out. I've now got something damn close to a 50-ohm transmitter at 100 watts output. If I adjust that output antenna tuner, if I adjust the antenna tuner for the output power meter, watt meter, to see maximum forward power, then when I'm finished doing that and I look at the input bird watt meter, I will see 1-to-1. The confusion here is that the transmitter is a constant current generator. The true power it's generating goes up and down as you make these adjustments. That makes the output power meter adjustment very difficult. Point number one is the second point. Second point is that the fact that a mismatched antenna gives you something other than a 50-ohm load at the output of the antenna tuner, at the input of the transmission line, makes people say, hey, it ain't 50 ohms, and the bird watt meter was designed for 50 ohms, therefore you can't use it. You can't believe the readings. There's a yes and a no to that. Every transmission line that has any reflected power is looking at a load that is not a 50 ohm resistor, period. Some other resistor, some other reactor. You ain't going to see 50 ohms on the input, no matter where you put that transmission line, the bird watt meter. That would lead you to believe you could never measure forward and reverse power with a bird watt meter. That's not true. If it's on a 50 ohm transmission line, I say you can always use a bird watt meter. You've got to be a little bit careful how you interpret the results. If I have a significant amount of standing wave ratio, the apparent forward power and the apparent reverse power will be a little bit crazy. I may have a true 100 watt transmitter in a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio system, and the bird watt meter may say 130 watts is flowing forward. That's perfectly okay if you know what you're doing. So to say that the load, you can't use a bird watt meter in anything but a perfectly matched system, if the system was perfectly matched and there's never any reverse power, why would there be a reverse port on the bird watt meter? Why would there be a reverse mode? I know you and I are not going to agree on this one at first, and I know that you and I are going to have a number of more discussions before we get down to the nitty-gritty on this one. I accept that. And this is a good, honest discussion among two guys who've got some strong opinions, and when the smoke finally settles, we're all going to get a little bit smarter. I accept that. K2 ILP. Straighten me out on this one, Bob. K2RIW.
K2RIW, the first thing you have to understand is that the antenna tuner that's used airborne is not feeding the transmission line. It's directly connected with an NSL to a probe antenna. On the older aircraft, like the Lockheed Connies, it was connected by a single wire that went out. The output part of the antenna coupler is a big ceramic cone. It doesn't have to be 50 ohms. It could be anything. And that impedance at that point of the output is a complex impedance. An antenna coupler can be having no insertion loss, perfect forward power on the watt meter, zero power reflected, if the impedance is matched. However, the power coming out of the antenna coupler, if it's feeding a non-resonant antenna that looks like a complex load, is complementing that load within the antenna coupler, and thereby the power that is in the antenna coupler that is really part of the antenna electrically is wasted. Now that is something that hams don't understand, because they only worked with antenna couplers where they actually measured the output power, which I say can only be measured by an electrostatic voltmeter and a thermocouple. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. You're suggesting that I can't put a bird watt meter after the antenna tuner when it directly feeds the antenna. Or if I do, I'm going to get erroneous results, and only an electrostatic voltmeter could be used. With the instrumentation that was used at Collins Radio in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, in the 1960s and 70s, you're probably right. I don't know if bird watt meters went to high enough power, the right frequency, whatever. However, there's a problem here. If I've got the bird watt meter in the shack with me right after the antenna tuner, feeding my transmission line, possibly you're going to accept that situation. If I make the transmission line shorter so that now I'm closer to the antenna, I think you'll accept that. If I move the whole system into an aircraft where the transmitter is in the nose of the aircraft, there's a transmission line going down the fuselage of the aircraft, and the antenna is coming out the tail of the aircraft, I think you would accept that. If now, step by step, I keep shortening that transmission line. I think Bob is telling me that at some particular length of transmission line that's approaching zero, all of a sudden I'm not allowed to do that. You can see there's a discontinuity here. Is there some magic length of transmission line that is not allowed? Is that length of transmission line that is not allowed, is it 100 feet? Is it 10 feet? Is it 1 foot? Is it 1 inch? Is it 1 millimeter? Where's the break? Careful now, wait for the beep. W2ILP, K2RIW.
Quarter wavelength.
K2RIW from W2ILP. First of all, there's no transmission line. There's a single wire that has to be less than a few feet long in the worst case, going to the antenna port on the aircraft, or going to the antenna probe and in a cell. Now, that wire is not at 50 ohms. It's not any kind of impedance that is regulated. The impedance can be anything. Because if you look at an antenna, if you go to the center of the antenna, you're at a low impedance, and as you go along the line of the dipole, the voltage increases, and that's where you have your sort of a half-wave pattern across part of the dipole. Now, we're looking at parts of the dipole with the output of the antenna coupler. We're not looking at a transmission line that's balanced into the input of something with a fixed impedance. We're looking into a complex load, and we have to match it by making a conjugate complex load. And when we do that, we're putting part of the antenna into the antenna coupler, and therefore losing actual output power, even though the board watt meter into the antenna coupler is measuring power, and there's no power reflected back to bother the transmitter. Back to you, Dick.
I've got two problems with that. One, if I'm losing power, does that mean the antenna tuner is getting hot? How do I lose power? If the transmitter is still a pure 50-ohm load, because I'm starting off with a kilowatt transmitter and a 10 dB attenuator, power attenuator, I've now got something very close to a 50-ohm, 100-watt transmitter feeding the antenna tuner. And the antenna tuner is right in the nacelle feeding that wider antenna that you described. And you're saying that because the antenna, part of the resonance is in the antenna tuner, there is loss.
Exactly what I'm saying, that part of the antenna is now in the antenna tuner, and if it's far less resonance, particularly on the lower frequencies, an appreciable amount of power is in there, and the components in there are rated to handle that power. They aren't rated to handle that power, even though the tuner may be pressurized with nitrogen, and it's very hard for that power to be radiated, but the components in there can handle it. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, if there's a very high standing wave ratio and a lot of the resonating energy is inside of the antenna tuner, and if I've done a good job of designing that antenna tuner, are you sure it has loss? And if it has loss, how does the loss show up? If it's a well-shielded antenna tuner, it's not radiating the power. And by the way, if it did radiate the power from the aircraft, maybe I'd be happy, but assume it's well-shielded and it's not radiating the power. How can it lose power if it's not generating heat? Back to you, Bob. Wait for the beep.
Dick, this is W2ILP again. And it is losing power. And the power is because some of the radiation resistance, so-called, is now inside the tuner. How much power it's losing depends upon how far off resonance and how much inductive or capacitive reactance has to be put into the tuner. But the tuner is actually absorbing that power, the component. all this in there have to be radiated to handle it, and even handle more while it's tuning up for optimizers, because it has a built-in reflectometer that actually is what's driving the servos that drive the motors that do all the work of tuning up. And there's two different reflectometers, one that measures only forward power, and that one that measures forward and reverse, and there's a state counter that goes through a number of criteria for this thing to finally settle and tune up. So, in the worst case, it can take 13 seconds to tune up, wherein the pilot gets a beep that it's ready. Back to you, Dick.
Bob, I know I'm sticking on a tough point here, but you got to give me an answer. Does the antenna tuner obey conservation of energy? If I build it out of good, low-loss components, and I don't care if I'm using the antenna at 3.5 megs and it really resonates at 7 megs, it's way out of resonance, and my antenna tuner is bringing it back into resonance, and I'm putting 100 watts into that antenna tuner. If I design that antenna tuner correctly, I say 100 watts is being radiated by that antenna. It must obey conservation of energy. If I'm putting 100 watts really into it, I say 100 watts is being radiated. Are you saying something else? If the antenna tuner is wasting power by conservation of energy, something's got to be getting hot if it's well shielded. Are you saying something different? Over to you, Bob. W2ILP, K2RIW, wait for the beep.
K2RIW from W2ILP. The antenna tuner, in taking part of the radiation resistance and putting it within its shielded body, is actually acting as a partial dummy load. It's actually absorbing the power and radiating it within the shielded compartment. And the components of that antenna tuner have to be able to handle that power. Now, there was another variation that Collins built called the 628T. It was an old solid state transceiver with the same specs as the 618T, which had vacuum tubes as the power output tubes. In designing it, they used computer-aided design to design their components for the output tuning before he even went into the antenna coupler. But when they start trying to use these 628Ts, they eventually had to call them all back because the components were exploding during the process of tuning up. And they lowered the power, they lowered it to 60 watts. But when it's seeing a bad load, what does it do? It gets hot. And if the components cannot take the voltage, the RF voltage breakdown, they're going to break down. It was another system we made for corporate aircraft that had an externally tuned vacuum capacitor in order to tune up on the lower frequencies. And that particular device was so bad, that the thing exploded. When there's a lot of RF power and voltage coming back inside the tuner, there is conservation of energy. Energy that's wasted in the tuner plus energy that's radiated by the antenna equals the energy that's coming out of the transmitter. So there's no conflict of power conservation. Back to you, Dick, from W2ILP.
Beautiful. You and I are coming to a very good agreement here. Yes, that device that had to be recovered was being used beyond design limitation. And those components were seeing too much voltage and arcing over, or too much current and overheating, beyond design limitation. That antenna was